It's Lions, Towers, and Shields from the Incomparable Network. Welcome back to A Discussion of Classic Film, Episode 85, Silent Sampler. I am not Shelley Brisbane. I'm guest host Mickey Maynard. And this week we're looking at silent movies. Why? Because I love silent movies and I talked Shelley into letting me do this. But I'm not alone in this episode. Each of our panelists will talk about one of their favorite silent films. Let's say hello to our panel. And Shelley, you kick things off.
Oh, hi. Somebody took over my show again, but it's easy to do. I hello, welcome. And I'm so glad to have you guest hosting and to be here, not guest hosting.
Next up, our resident Dutch woman, Annette Weerstra. Hi, Annette.
Hello. I'm really excited to be here. I have actually seen none of the movies, not even the one I recommended until recently.
Oh, until recently, she asked.
Recently. Okay. I did do my homework.
Hello to Nathan Alderman. Hi, Nathan.
Hi. I'm getting over a cold, so if I sound like a Dickensian miser at any point, please forgive me.
That's fine. Hello, Dr. Drang.
Hey. I had a boot for dinner, and I'm ready to go.
Right. Better that than a candle wick. And last but not least...
As long as you got salt.
Yeah, at least he had salt. And last but not least, Randy Detenga. Hi, Randy.
I have a spoiler about my movie. I was surprised to find out that it's gayer than the cast of Bewitched.
Okay, so as you heard in episode 82, Sunset Boulevard, I won't sing it this time. I discovered silent movies when I was a child, and almost 100 years after silent movies, they still provide a lot of vivid entertainment. If you've never watched a silent movie, the ones that we're talking about are all available on YouTube. And there's a wonderful series that you should know about. It's called The Story of Film, and it was made for Britain's Channel 4 by a Scottish filmmaker named Mark Cousins. The first few chapters of it are all about silent film, and it makes the point that silent movies were made all over the world. But Hollywood and European filmmakers turned them into an art form. I want to ask our panel... In an age when technology has transformed entertainment and you can watch these on a phone that you can hold in your hand, why do silent movies still matter?
I think it's because silent movies have influenced so many other things. Watching The Gold Rush, I was struck by the way Charlie Chaplin's little tiny movements were echoed in Chuck Jones's Wile E. Coyote cartoons. I think these are the foundational building blocks of cinema. I know that the movie I'll be talking about tonight has a pretty direct descendant in a very surprising place. So I think these films still matter, and a lot of them are still really entertaining.
I think it has something to do with the artistic way that they are created, both from, and a lot of it is from the way we see it in the 21st century. It looks like art because it's not the way films are made today. There's very different, and it feels like sort of a separate art form. And certainly it's a silent film is a precursor to many things that came after, but it's just so unusual in terms of the way we see it, but also in terms of the limitations that existed in terms of storytelling. And a lot of times, because of those limitations, silent film is not necessarily entirely realistic. You're sort of pantomiming, or you're sort of pointing at story elements or at the character development that you want people to understand. But because you have the limitation, not only of the lack of speech, but just the difference in terms of structure that creates, feel like silent filmmakers, even though they didn't know the difference, had to work to, you know, tell their stories with one hand behind their back. And obviously that's a perspective from somebody who has lived my entire life watching sound films, and they wouldn't obviously have that perspective. But it feels like as a watcher of film that a high proportion of what I see in silent film I react to as from an artistic perspective more than an entertainment perspective.
But that's not to say that so many of silent movies are really entertaining, even to modern audiences, like the Chaplin movie that we're going to watch. And I was thinking about the General and with Buster Keaton. I can't imagine a modern day movie that has such incredible stunts and is so just has that kind of excitement because you're not watching. Well, at least you don't know. I mean, I know there are special effects they use to kind of trick the eye, but it's so exciting and so death-defying that gives it this kind of special excitement because it's really real. And they managed to do it in a time when this film form was really just starting at the very beginning. You didn't know how fast to film movies. So silent movies it was hand cranked. So they'd be at different speeds and you might adjust it for like Keystone Cops to make it funnier by making it faster. But they were just figuring all this out and they didn't know what would work and what wouldn't. And they were setting standards for what we watch today.
Mm-hmm. I think they're entertaining on their own. They're different from what we're used to seeing, and you have to put yourself into a different space when you're watching one. But it's not like you're eating your vegetables. There are certain drawn out parts. You know, things often move slowly, but that's true even of sound movies that LTS deals with regularly. So they are just they're very nice. They're even when they aren't what you would normally watch, there's something in them that you can find interesting if you care about movies at all.
One of the things that I discovered in watching as many of our movies as I could was that, first of all, these are not those little short movies that you might have seen in film class or whatever. These are all epics. These are all full length, 2 hour about movies, and they tell real stories. Some of them are based on books. Some of them are original screenplays, but we're not cutting corners here on story development. A lot is going on in these movies. What we're going to do with this show, rather than do full recaps of six movies, because you would be here for a week. I'm going to have everybody talk about their movie, give us a couple highlights of the plot of their movie, and then talk about what in their movie really hit them the most. And Annette, I'm going to let you go first. Your movie is Nosferatu, and I have to say that it scared the bejeepers out of me. So please tell us why you chose Nosferatu.
I was really on the fence about choosing Nosferatu and The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which I have seen before, and both are horror movies. But I told Jelly, look, if I'm doing this, I'm picking a horror. It's sort of my jam. I think I picked Nosferatu because I hadn't seen it. And I think what really struck me in a way watching it was I'm very familiar with Dracula, the book, and kind of it's like seeing the birth of a language. So when you read the book of Dracula, you have, something that I feel like feels very familiar in terms of narrative, how we tell story. Yes, it's in another century than what we exist now. But so it's sort of a well-developed, familiar language vocabulary that we have with literature. But not that Nosferatu is Dracula. It's totally Dracula. I learned that they actually tried to destroy the movie because it was a copyright infringement at the time, which seems very fun that it still exists. But capturing sort of that story in the broad sweeps of film and without sort of like the depth and detail and the effects and the everything that we have available in a rich visual vocabulary now. But then you have some scenes and like one of my favorite scenes in the movie was when Nosferatu comes to London and he's brought with him coffins full of dirt from wherever cursed land he's from, because he has to bring this dirt with him. And there's like a parade of people carrying coffins down the street, and it's so creepy and so deliciously scary. And yet so simple. And so, like, in the paring down of the language, like, vocabulary that we have now, you get to something really essential. And it was really fascinating. And sort of like the parts that, because I don't watch silent movies except for when I do them for homework, but I really feel like the parts and the decisions around what text and what vocabulary or like language and lines, and in this case, they had quotes from books that they choose to use to emphasize the story. And then the stuff that they is playing out on screen, they are having sometimes conversations and you are not really getting the literal language, like words, but you are getting the acting. And I feel like Mac Schreck, who played Nosferatu, was so great at posing. And there's something just still so creepy about it that I wasn't disappointed. I'm still going to say there's something about the Dr. The cabinet of Dr. Caligari that has like the sets are kind of even creepier, but this was a very delightful horror to me.
Who else had a chance to watch it?
I did. I hadn't seen it before, and I was really glad to, because, and I'm not a horror person, so when I say that I enjoyed it and appreciated it, that is saying a lot for me, because I am not somebody who gravitates toward horror movies, but I was really eager to see it, because, you know, you think to yourself, what does a movie from 1921, how can that possibly be scary? And there are lots of ways. And some of them are the set pieces that Annette was talking about, like the coffins and just the sort of, you know, the shots of people looking frightened. But a lot of it is the acting. And you don't think sometimes about the degree to which a silent film did require of its performers a greater degree or a different kind of acting, because all of it has to be on your face. There are intertitles in Nosferatu, and more than there are in some silent movies I've seen. So a fair amount of the story is told in titles, but a lot of it really is told on the faces of the characters and the interactions. And it is, you know, it's very representational, as Annette said. You don't have all of the literal crossing of the T's and dotting of the I's in terms of the story, but you get it. And it actually made me think a lot about how to watch silent film. You have to have some understanding of that vocabulary, of what a certain thing means. You know, not only was silent film, you know, wasn't new by 1921, but silent film was also the first instance of media that was really available to people. And so they had to learn how to watch it and how to understand what the filmmaker was trying to get across. And it's both interesting to think about how the filmmaker chose to express himself, and also, you know, what those representational things he was doing communicated, and how scary was this for audiences of 1921. I suspect it was pretty scary.
There's also good romance, I'm going to say, between Hutter and Ellen.
I did not find the romance particularly appealing, because it's, you know, it's overplayed in the style of the time. What I loved about this movie, and I think, you know, if you've seen anything about movies, you may not have seen the movie, but you've seen pictures mm-hmm. of Nosferatu, of Count Orlok. And it may look funny to you if you've just seen the stills, but it's not funny. It's you don't look at this movie and laugh at it. I mean, obviously there are parts that are maybe a little bit laughable, but I don't think the Count Orlok stuff is funny. It really is scary and creepy, maybe more than scary. I think creepy is the right word in it. And also, there are some fascinating things about the way the movie was shot that, you know, there are special effects. There's the speeded up motion of certain things, like his the carriage that comes and takes what's his name Hutter up to the castle at the very end of his journey to Transylvania. That, you know, we all know what's going on at the time, and an audience in 1921 may very well not have known what's going on. with that kind of special effect, but it's still effective. And there are some other, there's another place where it's obviously a negative. He's showing, we're seeing the negative instead of a positive. And the other thing that I, and I've seen parts of the movie before, probably because of film class or something like that. But the things that I, one thing that I didn't remember at all is the different tone, the different color that's in this. Like some of the movie is sepia, some of it is kind of cyan, some of it is red-ish. You know, there's a tinge to it. And I, as I was starting to watch it, I was wondering whether this is because they had to recreate the movie from bits and pieces that they found, you know, in a Yugoslavian library, and this one was in an Australian junkyard or whatever, you know, how old movies like this are reconstructed. But I don't think so. I think it was, this was deliberate because they seem, these color tones seem to have to do with the time of day it is and to some extent how you're supposed to feel. So it's very interesting for that reason. The movie holds your interest. It's just really the only thing that I care about in a movie is, does it keep me watching? And Nosferatu kept me watching.
I was really intrigued by the print that I watched. It just is really fantastic. Obviously, it's been worked on, but I think of a lot of silent movies as having poor prints and having all these performers and really that garish silent movie makeup with and from what I've been reading that the film that they used changed by the 1920s and they were using a better quality of film and you didn't need all that kind of garish makeup to make your facial features stand out. So I assume maybe this was this movie was one of the ones that used the better film because it seemed so high quality and very high defined and didn't seem to have at least on some of the characters, you know, that really garish makeup. But Nosferatu is his own character with his own makeup.
All right. I want to move on to Shelley's movie, which takes place at the very end of the silent movie era. And it's also kind of a dark topic. So, Shelley, why don't you tell us about Diary of a Lost Girl?
So, like Nosferatu, Diary of a Lost Girl is a German film. I thought it was interesting that we sort of bookended the beginning and the end of the 20s with the silent movies we're talking about tonight with German films. It is directed by G.W. Pabst, a German director, but it stars Louise Brooks, an American actress who is the reason that film is known today. She is super interesting. I could just talk about Louise Brooks all day. She's very young. She's known for the 20s bob haircut that she has, but also just a very physically expressive person, and much more so than I think a lot of actors in silent film seem to be. She was a dancer. She was very lithe and very physically graceful and just compelling to watch. She had made movies in Hollywood for 4 or 5 years before this. She had come to Hollywood. She had been a dancer. She was raised in the Midwest. She had come to Hollywood and made movies and basically got tired of the Hollywood BS very soon. I mean, here she is, this young sort of ingenue, and you would think, well, she's got however long her career and she's going to do what they tell her for a while so that she can be famous. But Louise Brooks pretty much is like, you know, I'm kind of tired of this. And so when she gets an offer to go to Berlin by G.W. Pabst, she goes to Weimar, Germany in 1928, and she makes a movie called Pandora's Box with him. And then this is the second movie they make together. It was a difficult call to decide whether to do Pandora's Box or Diary of a Lost Girl. I personally enjoy Diary of a Lost Girl more, I think, because Pandora's Box is a little bit more of a morality tale, and the woman ends up in a little bit worse shape, I think, in Pandora's Box than she does in Diary of a Lost Girl. And in Diary of a Lost Girl, there's all these various plot pieces that happen. It's not all one linear thing. So Louise Brooks is a character called Thiamin. She is a young, a virginal 16. She's her first confirmation. And on the day of her first confirmation, we discover that something has happened to the housekeeper, and she's died. She's drowned. And it turns out that her father has impregnated this housekeeper. And soon, Louise Brooks herself will be impregnated by the guy who works for her father, who is a pharmacist. And of course, because she has been impregnated through rape, we have to send Louise off to a reformatory, where she is unfortunately meets up with the very stern and evil matron and her tall, bald henchman. She does not like it. She's treated very badly. She escapes. She becomes a high-class prostitute, and through various machinations, her father eventually dies, and she has access to the money from his estate. So that's sort of her only hope of, you know, after she's been a call girl, that was a means of success for her, and then she has the hope of getting her father's estate, but she ends up giving that money to her father's second wife and the children that they've born, because she doesn't want her half-sisters to experience what she herself did in her young life, which annoys the man who has come into her life. And that's a short synopsis of the plot with a lot of things missing. But like I say, one of the main reason to watch this movie is the compelling Louise Brooks. I don't think you can look at the screen when she's on it and not be compelled. Pabst is interesting as a filmmaker, because when you think about German filmmaking in the 20s, you think about, you know, expressionism and sort of high art. But he's much more realistic. And it's a melodrama, really. I mean, Louise Brooks sort of elevates it with her performance, and I think it's a well-made film. But all in all, it's a melodrama. It's a story that's easy to follow. There are a lot of characters who mean Louise Brooks no good, and she ends up not on top, but she gets to make her own decisions. She gets to say, I don't want this cycle to repeat, and so I'm going to take whatever money I have, and I'm going to make sure somebody gets it who can, you know, have more self-determination than I did in my young life. And I really enjoy it. Because, as I say, I think it's so much more expressive than a lot of silent films are because of her performance. And it's notable that this is kind of her last great film. She's very young. She goes back to Hollywood. She makes a few very unsuccessful films in the 30s. And unlike a lot of these kinds of stories, I think she just got fed up. It wasn't so much that Louise Brooks hit hard times. She didn't go to drink, and I mean, she eventually does have she eventually becomes a call girl later in her life, which is obviously not an end that one would wish. But Louise Brooks basically said to Hollywood, I've had it. I'm not going to put up with all the things that are required of me to be a Hollywood star. And she basically left at a very young age, which also adds to her mystique quite a bit. And as I say, it's a lovely film to watch and a great performance.
She has such an unforgettable face. And literally, this is what Norma Desmond was talking about when she said, we had faces then. You meet her right at the beginning of the movie, and the camera zooms in on her, and there's the haircut and the eyes, and you just are like, who is this woman? I was spellbound by looking at her.
Yeah, I absolutely. And I saw this for the first time on the big screen, for which I'm eternally grateful. I saw a double feature one night at the Alamo Drafthouse with this and a Pandora's Box. And it was kind of awesome and overwhelming. And I think her beauty is something of note, but also just the way she moves. I mean, she starts out as this sort of innocent young girl. But even in that state, before we know anything about her character, the way she moves and the way she compares in scenes to the other people, because most of the other people in the movie are men. There are a couple of other women. She has a friend, and then she has this cruel matron. But she's in a lot of scenes surrounded by middle-aged, button-up men who mean her ill, and it's just, she's magnetic.
As Shelley said, you can't take your eyes off of her when she's on the screen. And you know, Pabst has close-ups of her all the time, but he has close-ups of everybody, and there are a lot of grotesque people in this movie. The pharmacist who rapes her is just the most. Oh my God! Yeah, I mean he is worse than Nosferatu in just in the way he looks. And you know, the madam we have, you know, big zooms on her, the bald guy who is at the whatever the reform school or the place for wayward girls is awful, and the matron at that place is awful, and we see their faces in extreme close up, and we are supposed to hate them, and we do, and it's very effective filmmaking from that point of view. I do know, though, that the reason Shelley chose this film is because it has Sig Arnow in it doing a comic role. And I was looking, you know, the last Lions, Towers, and Shields I was on was the Palm Beach story where Sig Arnow is playing a goofy character, and he plays a wonderful goofy character in this movie as well, where he's the he is the guy who comes to see Louise Brooks to get dancing lessons from her. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And he does a great job, of course.
It's all about the minor characters.
I kind of noped out of this film after, they react to Louise Brooks getting raped by this horrible man who they know raped her by sending her to Frau Blücher's Junior Lesbian Academy. I was struck because I'd heard all these things about Louise Brooks. Obviously, like Audrey Tautou and Amelie, one of my favorite movies, has the Louise Brooks Lulu Bob. So I was always really fascinated to watch a movie with Louise Brooks. And maybe she goes through a transformation that I missed because I noped out of the film. But I was just struck by her lack of screen presence. I found it interesting that she felt like a real normal human being on screen. But I was like, where's the tantalizing screen goddess that I've heard so much about?
You fell asleep.
I didn't see it here. I thought the movie was really well made and beautifully photographed. It looks incredible, but it just, I was surprised.
Not your kind of movie. I think if you see Pandora's Box, for me, that one is the stronger movie of the two, but they kind of do make a double feature.
I would absolutely be up for seeing Pandora's Box.
They may both have been, but Pandora's Box certainly has been restored. I know there's a Criterion release. I'm not sure whether that's what I have or not, but I have some Blu-ray box that has Pandora's Box in it, and it's just beautifully restored. This movie is available, but I think has been given a little less attention.
Yeah.
Well, I may have I watched the YouTube version and that you linked to, Shelley, and it was 2 hours long. And this is very common in movies from this era, is that there are lots of different cuts. This was the longest cut.
Yes, and I apologize for that.
Nathan, if that's the one you saw, there are parts where you know, come on, let's get going here. Come on now. That's too much. Too much.
There's three or four cuts
of
that movie.
Yeah. IMDb says it's an hour and 19, and that's not the movie I saw.
I saw the long version too, and I did up the speed at which I watched it. Sometimes, but
Diary of a Keystone Girl.
Yes, like a little like. But I wanted to try and watch the whole thing. I was really interested in the fact that there was so blatantly a rape. There was so blatantly a brothel and sex. And I'm like, I'm used to watching with all you folks these movies where we just walk around and everyone pretends that they're not having sex, but they all are having sex. But, you know, like, kind of interesting to see, like, and I understood how the code came in and that history, but actually watching this movie and The Sheik as well, where sex was so prevalent, of course, we just are used to thinking of older generations of stuff being so much more prudish. But it's like, no, it wasn't always like that. There was just that period of time when they took that away from us. And I agree. It was hard, like, seeing. I was like, oh, shit, this is like an actual rape happening here. And I did not expect that. But I did like how she was an empowered character at the end. And I think Dr. Drang, you're right. Like around the close-ups, I think that really helped to create a very strong sense of character in this movie that wasn't in all of the other movies that we watched. You just really like in kind of a shorthand for creating a very strong sense of person in a lot of these roles.
One of the things that I discovered in rereading Gloria Swanson's autobiography was that there was a production code for silent American movies. And she actually had to maneuver around it when they made Queen Kelly and Rain, or I guess they called it Sadie Thompson. And there was Will Hayes was right there in Hollywood in the 20s, but the code didn't apply to European right. filmmakers. And right. that's how these scenes, these sort of graphic scenes, were able to be shown. Because when we get to The Sheik, and we'll talk about that in a second, but there's a lot in the original book of The Sheik that did not right. make it into the movie. And the critics actually said, hey, wait a minute. You know, if you read the book, this isn't the way the book went. So moving on from a real downer, let's go to less of a downer with Flesh and the Devil, which, as we were saying, has a little bit in common with our favorite blog, Gene Kelly's Butt. So, yay. So take it over, Randy.
Well, this movie is about two best buddies who have to choose between their friendship and Greta Garbo, and their choice may surprise you, especially since Greta Garbo is just luminous. Just this is a movie. This movie makes me think about standards of beauty over the eras, and John Gilbert was a real movie heartthrob at the time. He's the first build on the film poster above the title when Greta is down on the side, and I feel like his kind of early movie attractiveness doesn't really hold up to me. He's a kind of a creature of his time, and so is Rudolph Valentino, who we're still going to talk about. But Garbo is just a revelation, and the idea that that these two guys that are soldiers, and it's kind of a long story, but one of them ends up having an affair with a married Garbo and gets sent off to the boonies, and then there's a duel in there somewhere, but anyway, it's basically about these two guys having a love triangle with Greta Garbo. But it's not really a triangle. It's just kind of a straight line between these two guys that are very physical with each other and have. I mean, it's really hard to tell in an old movie like this when you're like, is there gay in this movie, or am I seeing it from my perspective?
A modern perspective, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of...
Wasn't just you, just Randy.
Well, I do have a habit of seeing gay in everything. But,
No, it wasn't just you. It was not just
especially
you.
Especially if you think about that opening sequence in the barracks where the guys are, like, doing their exercises in their underwear. And whoa!
Yeah.
Everyone's mouths are so close to one another in this movie. Everyone, men, ladies, everybody.
Yeah, and it's... And I just was wondering, and this is based on a German book from, I think, the 1880s or 1890s. And I wonder how much of that kind of tension was in the book. And then they do choose each other over Greta Garbo. It's, you know, a case of bros over you know what in this movie. And this is what we were talking about. The Louise Brooks movie could be a little slow. This is one of the silent movies that I've watched where I kind of wish I had a 1.5 speed like I do for podcasts. Not this one, of course, but I want to hear every moment in real time. But I kind of wanted to speed it along. But it's just such a, and the cinematography is fantastic. And the cinematographer, whose name's going to pop up here, William H. Daniels, Greta Garbo and Daniels, just I think they just adored each other. And he ended up doing many of his of her movies, of her most famous movies. And And this the filmmaking, I mean, the cinematography and the scene with when they're out, John Gilbert and Greta are outside and he's lighting a match. It's a very sexy, luminous, wonderful scene. So as a movie, I think it kept my interest the whole way through. It did have some slow periods, but it's just looking at this is a movie where you really admire the craft and you see the star being born in Greta Garbo, and you see why. I can't really see why John Gilbert was such a big star. I don't see what his appeal was. But with Greta, she's as captivating, I'm sure, as she was then. She is now from a modern perspective.
The only thing I would argue that could be more stunning than Greta Garbo in this film, because holy cats, she looks great, is the very first duel scene, which is filmed entirely in silhouette from a distance, almost all in a single shot. It is incredibly cleverly staged to tell you exactly what's going on without almost any words, and ends on a delightful note of suspense that you don't find out what happened until the following shot. It's really one of the most cleverly staged shots I've seen in a silent film.
Does anyone know, is this remade as a talkie?
I don't believe so, but I don't. Okay. I couldn't swear to it. It's interesting, yeah, to me, because I've not seen it before we did it for this, but I've seen clips of it and I know something of the legend of it. And the sort of gay subtext or whatever you want to call it, or even the buddy aspect of the movie, is not what is brought down in film lore. You know, what you think of is this is when Garbo and Gilbert were getting together in real life. And there was, in fact, a wedding, which she basically got cold feet and said, no, I'm not gonna. And so the chemistry between them and the shots that you see when you see, clips of this movie are all this sort of grand passion between them. And you find out when you watch the movie, as is usually the case, that there's a lot more to it. She is clearly the center of this movie. And both Clarence Brown, who was a frequent director of hers, he was not somebody who was a particularly distinguished artistic director, but he was Greta Garbo's director. And so when he directed her, things happened that were great, as well as William Daniels being the cinematographer. But it's just interesting. And Gilbert, of course, famously did not have much of a career past talkies. And it was more complicated than his voice, which you can hear in some pretty decent talkies. He doesn't have a Tweety Bird voice. He's fine. Basically, he drank himself to death and he died in like 1936. And so Gilbert had many problems that perhaps contributed to his problems in film. I haven't read a whole lot about him, but you know, they're both at the height of their powers in this movie. And it's interesting to sort of be honest enough to say Gilbert might not have been the heartthrob in the same way we think of male heartthrobs today, but Garbo still shines through.
And what's also kind of amazing that Greta gave this great performance when she was really angry with MGM. She had just done The Temptress, and her sister had died of cancer back in Sweden, and she wanted to make a trip back, and MGM wouldn't let her. And she was really, really upset about that. They wanted her to do this movie, but that she... it's tribute to her that she was professional about it and gave a great performance, and managed to really spark her career. Is one of the, I don't know, would you say the top 5 or 10 movie stars of all time?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think so. And I mean, I've always been obsessed with Garbo a little bit. I've pretty much seen every movie that she's made. And when I lived in New York, she was still alive when I lived in New York. And I actually went for a walk so that I could walk by her apartment. I never did see her. I saw Katharine Hepburn on the street, but I never saw Garbo, which is, I guess, appropriate.
Yeah, when her apartment was sold, they actually had images of what it looked like when she owned it. She left it to her niece, I believe, and then they eventually sold it. But there were photos taken, and it was decorated and was very, very specific to Garbo's tastes, which was super interesting to see, given that, you know, she had been reclusive for so many years. Even though, apparently sightings in New York were relatively common if you just were on the street.
Mickey, how do you put this in her oeuvre of her performances? How does it stand up?
So I've always liked this movie just because it's such a pretty movie. I would include it in top five. I think Camille is my favorite Garbo movie, and she did make that as a silent movie and as a talkie. Queen Christina, which, you know, is very heavy with lesbian subtext, but what gorgeous shots. And of course, she had her own director and her own cameraman for most of the time. So I'd say three or four for me.
Isn't Camille the one where she speaks for the first time and she wants a double whiskey? Is that what it is?
Anna Christie. Yeah.
Don't be stingy, baby.
And don't be stingy, baby. Yeah.
Oh, did she laugh? And the she laughs, Camille?
Maybe that's it. Was made of Camille.
No, she doesn't. Well, she probably laughs at Camille, but
that's later on.
Garbo laughs as Ninotchka.
Right.
Yeah.
But Camille is like 1937, talking version of it. I don't remember when the silent movie was made.
And the talking person, I think it's Frederick March.
Robert Taylor, in
Some Camille.
Boring guy.
Yeah. She's so gorgeous in Camille. I mean, it's just heart stopping.
Well, it's like Vaseline on the lens and the beautiful costumes. Yeah. And it's just so, it's very, very, very pretty.
Apparently she was not an intellectual. I mean, I don't want to say she was stupid, but, you know, she's not a brainy person. She was all about her appearance and her sort of gliding through life kind of thing. And so people who knew her said that, you know, she had this beautiful face that you read whatever you wanted to see in it. So the last scene of Queen Christina, where she's on the end of the boat and she's just looking into the distance, nobody really knows what Garbo was thinking in that shot. And we're just supposed to layer over it. Is it regret? Is it excitement? Is it, is she going to throw herself off the ship? You know, so she just had that kind of a face that you could project what you wanted to project onto it.
Which is so interesting for her mystique, right? Because it means you can make of her, beyond the fact that she's beautiful, you can make of her a lot of what you want to. And I think people did. And, you know, her legend looms large because she left film so early. Ninotchka is pretty much her last film.
No, it was Two-Faced Woman.
Yeah, which, you're right. But it's
with the bathing suit scene. Yeah. So 1940. So she's basically World War II happens. Everybody forgets about her. And then there are some efforts for a comeback for her, and they never happened.
I'm trying to remember that movie right after the war that they tried to get her into. But and I thought,
the
that would
Barclays
be
of Broadway? No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Oh, they asked her to do Sunset Boulevard, right?
Yes, there was an overture made to her.
I bet there
for
was
Sunset
zero
Boulevard.
Chance that she would ever have done that.
No.
Yes.
No. And someone set her up. I'm trying to remember who her lover, patron, or whatever was after World War II. And I know that
George something, I think.
Yeah, she didn't lack for money. She had a beautiful apartment, Sutton Place, and. And, you know, she was able to kind of just disappear into the, you know, the hustle and bustle of the city of New York.
There is an alternative ending that I got on the DVD that I watched. Did you guys see that? Those of you who watched it? It's an alternate ending where the John Gilbert character ends up with the sister of the other guy, the sister of the Lars Hansen character. Remember, he had that younger sister, Hertha, not Bertha, Hertha. And so Hertha ends up with John Gilbert. It's a very short alternative ending, but it's basically a happy ending. It's like, oh, Greta slides beneath the ice and everybody lives happily ever after except for Greta.
Well, and I think at that point in time, you know, 1926, that she wasn't as big a star as she would become. And if it was 5 years later, they would have figured out an ending so that, you know, she stood on the end of the boat and just looked off into the distance or something.
Yes.
But, yeah, she was dispensable at this point in Hollywood history.
I do love the tiny kid in the military uniform who keeps trying to dance with the little sister yes. character at the dance early in the film. That indignant reaction shot from him is an all-timer, and you get the strong sense that in another 12 years, this kid's going to be leading a Wehrmacht battalion.
Well, moving from wherever we are to Algeria, I want to bring up The Sheik, and we have a couple of comedies coming up, but let's get through kind of our more serious movies, and then we'll sort of go on to a happier note. So my movie is The Sheik, or The Sheik, however you want to pronounce it. It is the movie that's considered the one that made Rudolph Valentino a star, and in fact, a star whose image is still very vivid with us today, even though he's been dead for almost 100 years. He was an actor, and he had been in a movie with Gloria Swanson called Beyond the Rocks, and apparently it doesn't exist. Nobody has found a print of it. But she was a huge star, and he was an up-and-coming star, and she knew that he was going to be something, and so she wanted him for her movie. But by 1921 and The Sheik, he is now firmly established as a star. So The Sheik is based on a novel by E.M. Hall. It came out in 1919, and just to give you a little context, anything Middle Eastern, anything Egyptian, you know, it was fascinating to people. T.E. Lawrence of Arabia captured people's attention in World War I because he led an Arab revolt. And then this is the time when they're looking for King Tutankhamun's tomb. They would find it in 1924, but they're out there looking for it at this point in time. So there's kind of a fascination of the culture of the Middle East. And so when the movie opens, you see Rudolph Valentino sweeping in, and he's identified as the Sheik. This is Algeria. This is called, I guess it's Biskra, Algeria. And his name is Sheik Ahmed Ben Hassan. So Sheik Hassan swoops in at the beginning of the movie. And then the next character that we meet is Lady Diana Mayo, who is a spunky British aristocrat. And she meets him, but in kind of interesting circumstances. She's out with her friends. He's taken over a ballroom in one of the hotels, and they tell her that no white people are allowed in the hotel, only Arabs. And it's because he and his tribe have swooped in, taken over the ballroom, and there's a dancing girl up front. And of course, Lady Diana says, oh no, you're not going to keep me out. And so she goes backstage and she bribes the dancing girl to get her it doesn't really show money changing hands, but she gets the dancing girl costume and she comes out into the ballroom, and we think that she's going to entertain us, but then they figure out that she's not an Arab. She's actually a British aristocrat. She's white, and they kick her out. But the Sheik has seen her. And at night, she's, I think, kind of stupidly left the door to her suite open. And he climbs up the side of the building and leaps over the railing and goes into her bedroom. Now, in the book, he rapes her. And there's going to be more rapes in the book, but he just stands there and looks at her at this point in time. So fast forward, she decides that she wants to go and explore the desert. She rides out with her brother. Then she says to her brother, hey, I'm fine out here as the only woman for 400 miles in the desert. And she gets kidnapped. And she ends up in the Sheik's tent. And of course, she's freaking out. And we don't see him move on her, but we assume that he moves on her. She's lethargic. She's depressed. She's sad. He's trying to woo her. And he's like, why do you find my kisses so distasteful? Well, 'cause you kidnapped me. And then he kind of doles out these little favors. You know, he tells them, okay, she doesn't have to dress as an Arab woman. She can have her British clothing back. And it turns out he has a French butler, and the French butler is, we don't know this yet, but he's a link to the Sheik's education in Paris. Then the Sheik has a friend come from France who happens to be Adolphe Manjou. And she's embarrassed by this whole thing, and she doesn't want his friend from Paris to see her in the harem of the Sheik. But the sheik says, well, you can wear your dinner clothes and you should join us for dinner. And he'll be, it is my wish that you join us for dinner. And she joins him for dinner. And then I think he's like, what the heck are you doing here? And she wants to leave, and the sheik, you know, doesn't let her leave. But then there's an opportunity for her to leave. And she tries to get away, and she gets captured by the other tribe, and then they come and rescue her. And then the sheik gets injured. So here's the sheik, and the sheik is lying in bed. And it's the first time we actually get to see Rudolph Valentino's full head, because most of the time he's wearing a burnous. He's wearing heavy robes and head coverings, and he's now lying in bed with a little cap on, and you can actually see full Rudy at that point. And she holds his hand and she says, oh, his hand is kind of large for an Arab. I mean, the dialogue in this movie is like, what the heck? But she says, his hand is large for an Arab. And Adolf Nagy says, well, he's not an Arab. He's Spanish and English. And in the book, his parents were murdered. And the sheik, who's controlling the territory, takes him in and trains him to be the next sheik. In the movie, they just say that his parents died tragically and he was adopted by the sheik. And that's how he got to be the sheik. So we find out that the sheik is actually European, and that kind of makes all this kidnapping okay. And so at the end of the movie, he wakes up and they're holding hands and scene. And we don't actually know at the end of the movie if they end up together, if she goes back to Britain, if she stays to be one of the wives of the sheik. But they ended up kind of inconclusively. But for me, I mean, I think just the fact that he becomes this massive heartthrob, you know, he's the Brad Pitt of his day. I mean, he's someone that everybody is following in the movie magazines, and he has a couple of marriages. And then there was actually a sequel to this movie with pretty much the same cast called Son of the Sheik, in which he plays both the older sheik and then his son. And then there was supposed to be, or I guess there was a third sequel called I'm a Sheik, which starred B.B. Daniels, and they turned it into a comedy. And then Rudy Valentino, as everybody knows, dies. So his career was cut short, but this was the movie that made him so vivid to audiences literally around the world.
I assume that the thing about him seeming to be an Arab but not being an Arab, but they might be, but they work together under whatever circumstances, is an anti-miscegenation thing, because we can't have that race mixing, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I didn't read that for sure, but that would be my guess.
No, that was how I read it, too, that, mm-hmm. you know, it didn't matter that he kidnapped her and probably was forcing himself on her. The fact that he was a European doing it made it all fine. Which, of course, it wasn't, but, you know, the movie is just, I don't think you could make it today in the way that it was made. And I'm honestly kind of surprised that it caught on with so many people, because, you know, the guy's abusing her. And yet it's a little bit of Stockholm syndrome. You know, she's his captive, and he does treat her kindly in the scenes that we see, but the inference is that, you know, then he's having his way with her. And, you know, lucky for her that she doesn't get pregnant like Louise Brooks.
Well, and it's disappointing, too, because she begins the movie as she's a socialite, but she is a person of some substance even among her friends. And she does what she wants, and she's independent. She says, I'm not going to get married because it would cramp my style. And then we bring her down in the same way that so many women in so many movies for 100 years have been brought down.
And, Philadelphia Story. Yeah. It's a lot of independence. I mean, this is 1921, and she's out there in the desert by herself. She's leading her friends. Her brother's there, but you know, it's not like he leads a pack to come and rescue her. What I think is fascinating is that, you know, he kidnaps her, and there's just not really an effort from town to come and get her.
I've actually read the book in Morocco with my two best friends out loud. And I'm going to tell you, when you read a book out loud, you remember it very well. So I was super excited to watch this movie because I was like, how did they make this into the movie? We wanted to read it because it's sort of a prototype of a genre of romance, which is very violent and sort of the kidnapping and rape to falling in love, which is a highly problematic thing, but that does happen in romance. They even did one recently on Netflix called 365 Days. And I was like, oh, that's The Chic, totally a remake of The Chic. So it's still like a thing that's happening. But what was really interesting to me was how they did pull back on, because it is very violent in the book, surprisingly so. And I do remember the moment when we got to the book and we're reading it and we found out he's European. So we're like, oh, this is so bad. This is like, if this book was bad all the way through. And so I was waiting to see if they were going to do the same thing in the movie, which they did. And in the book, they do end up together. So I was reading the movie as such that she was going to end up with him and that, oh, it's okay that he did all these really horrible things to you because at least he's a European. Oh, that's no problem. So it was just fascinating to see like a book I think should never have been written made into a movie. And knowing Rudolph Valentino, who is really good at leering horribly, and he's mm-hmm. quite creepy, I thought, in a lot of it, where he's yeah. just leering at her. And I'm like, oh, like, you know, I think the implication is more than what we see on screen. And because the book, I think, was only 2 years before the movie, people probably, may have read both the movie and
I think they
the
did, given that book. Yeah. Mickey's right that the critical response to the changes they made between the book and the movie was pretty significant.
So were they upset that they...
Oh, yeah, they were upset. Yeah.
They were upset that they took out the violence?
Yeah, they really dulled it down. I'm not going to say dumbed it down, but it was very well known. It was, you know, a fantasy book and familiar to people. And then here comes the movie and they've taken all of it out. And he even, you know, goes in her room and nothing happens, mm-hmm. Which seems, you know, totally unlikely.
Still pretty creepy.
I mean, he's a chic. I mean, come on. Yeah. Yeah. The interesting thing about, you know, you're talking about the leering and the teeth and all that. And I thought, oh, bleh. But then there are some scenes where he's just sort of calm and smiling. And you can see the charm about him mm-hmm. When he calms down a little bit. I can absolutely see why women were, you know, were fainting over him at the time.
Well, I don't.
I'm with you
I
on that.
Know.
I
watched this movie.
I have screenshots I could send you.
the leery stuff. I mean, he bugs his eyes uh-huh. out a lot. Uh-huh. And maybe that does it for people. I don't know, or did at the time. But I was expecting him, Mickey mentioned, you know, he's got the head covering on all the time. And I was, except for one scene, and I was kind of expecting to see him, you know, stripped to the waist or mm-hmm. something that would make women faint. You know, in 1920, whatever
21.
This was, 21, yeah. 22. Yeah. So, and it never happened. I kept, well, I am going to see something that is going to be, you know, just knockout gorgeous coming. And I just didn't see it. And the bugging his eyes out, I didn't see why anyone would think that was attractive. Undoubtedly, women at the time were just, you know, waiting to be ravished by him, but I didn't see it.
Same. I kept looking at him. Granted, I pieced out right around the time that she's thinking about going into the party, because I'm like, I can see exactly where this film about a independent lady who likes wearing pants is going. And then I read Wikipedia and I was like, wow, it's even worse. But I kept looking at Valentino and thinking.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think about, okay, so it's 1921 and who are our screen idols in 1921? Fairbanks?
Well, Fairbanks?
Yeah, Fairbanks, yeah. I think. Yeah.
Who does strip to the waist in a lot of movies.
That's true.
I have to say, I would be a fan of stripping to the waist. I'm gonna, just going to say that.
Yeah, I think it's just mystique. I think it's the whole atmosphere of horses and sand. And, you know, there's a debate over where this was actually filmed. Was it? Someone said it was filmed on Montauk, in Long Island? I don't think so.
There's some dispute about whether it was filmed in California or New York or how much in each place, or by memory is. Because they were doing a lot of movies in New York in those days even.
Yeah. And Mickey, haven't we talked before, Mickey, about how you really appreciate a guy with acreage?
Oh, absolutely. Well, the guy's got a lot of sand. I can say that.
Well, and he's got big hands.
That's true.
I was sort of curious to know whether the size of one's hands based on race was a stereotype that was known at the time. I've never heard that one. Thankfully.
No, I have no idea.
That inner title was funnier than anything I saw in the Gold Rush or the General. It was fantastic.
It's like phrenology, but somehow even dumber.
It also implies that our heroine knows whereof she speaks for some reason.
Oh.
Okay, I'm looking at pictures of Douglas Fairbanks, and I'm going to say he is much handsomer.
Yeah.
Okay. Besides all the swashbuckling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't explain it, but he did. He became a massive star.
So. Well, I mean, it's not like Fairbanks wasn't a massive star.
What
he was.
Years ago, we're thinking. Go. Yeah.
Well, probably 100 years from now, people are going to be like, Brad Pitt? What were you thinking?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Clooney, yeah. Okay, so I think we've taken the Sheik apart enough. Let's have some fun movies. So let's talk about the Gold Rush, which is just such a... It is sad in parts, but it's a really fun movie.
Yeah, this is a cheap choice on my part because... Who doesn't like this movie? It is a 1925 Chaplin movie. He is playing, at this point, he is still playing the little tramp. The character's name is the Lone Prospector. And this is about, the setting for the movie is the Alaska Gold Rush of about the turn of the century. So about, 25, 30 years earlier. And Charlie is a prospector who goes up, and he is dressed as the little tramp, even though everybody else around him is dressed in giant furs and everything like that. He has his bowler hat. He has his cane. He has, I think, some pots and pans attached to him. But basically, he looks characteristically like the little tramp. And he goes up, has... a variety of adventures. There are two main settings for this movie. One is up on the mountain where there is a cabin where certain hijinks happen, and also where the other main character, which is Big Jim, another prospector who's played by Max Swain, another one of the Keystone folks. He's there. He finds, as he says, a mountain of gold while he's there. There's that setting. And then there's a gold rush town somewhere, I think, down the mountain somewhere where it's, basically a town that sprung up out of nowhere as the gold rush happened. And there's a dance hall with pretty girls and Jack, the ladies man. And so... what happens in the movie, it's a series of set pieces, although I do think there is a coherent plot to this movie. There's a villain who's Black Larson. Guy's name is Black Larson. He has this cabin up on the mountain. There's a giant storm. Charlie... Black Larson and Big Jim are trapped in the cabin. They eventually, Black Larson draws a bad card. He has to go out. and try to find food for them because they're starving. He goes out, he kills some people, he gets some food, he does not go back to the cabin, he finds Big Jim's claim, and there are some other, we'll talk about the different set pieces, but basically Big Jim and Charlie find some food through shooting a bear. They leave the cabin, they go their separate ways. Big Jim gets hit on the head by Black Larson, loses his memory. Black Larson gets killed by the law of the Klondike or something. Anyway, he falls off. There's a crevasse opens up and he falls to his death. And then we go into the town where Charlie meets a dance hall girl, Georgia, and falls in love with her. Of course, she doesn't care about him at all, but she uses him to make Jack, the ladies' man, jealous. There are a variety of back and forths between Georgia, Jack, the ladies' man, and Charlie. Charlie ends up acting as sort of the valet of another prospector who has a cabin just outside of town. That prospector goes out with his prospecting buddies, leaving Charlie alone in the cabin. He has some interaction with the dance hall girls at the cabin. Eventually, Big Jim wanders into this Gold Rush town with his memory gone. He sort of remembers enough that he had a claim. He finds Charlie. We've got to go back to the cabin. They go back to the cabin on the mountain. They have misadventures there, which are, again, really good. They find the gold. They become rich. They get on a ship to go back to the mainland, down to the lower 48. And Georgia is on the ship. She and Charlie meet, and they end up happily ever after. That's the movie. The great things about this are the set pieces in the movie that are so well done and so beautifully acted or performed. I was reminded, repeatedly during this movie of whether it's true or not, the story of W.C. Fields talking about Charlie Chaplin as, you know, he's that goddamn ballet dancer. It's beautiful what he does in this movie. And in particular, there are two dinner scenes in the movie. The first one is a Thanksgiving dinner in the cabin with Big Jim, where they have no food, and Charlie boils his boot as their food. And so he ladles gravy onto it, effectively, you know, the water that he boiled the boot into. So the boot becomes the meat course. The laces of the boot are treated like spaghetti. The nails that go up through the soles into the boot are like fish bones. It's wonderfully done and very inventive. And then the part that I don't remember when I first saw this, but I was probably in my teens. So I've known about this for, 50 years, is the Oceana Roll, which is a dance that Charlie does during a dream sequence where he takes two dinner rolls, sticks forks in them, and puts his head down as if they are his, you know, the forks and the rolls are his legs, and he does a dance. And it's fascinating and it's beautiful. I'm not sure that it's funny, but you can't take your eyes off of it. It is like what we were always told about how Fred Astaire insisted on being shot full body so that everybody knew that he was dancing because he's the special effect. It's the same thing here. This is, the camera is locked down. You're just looking at Charlie. There's nothing going on. He is the special effect, and it is marvelous. So that's the movie, and I'm interested in hearing what everyone else had to say.
I was so impressed at how this movie was paced. with so many of these films, I found myself staring at my watch, thinking that these shots were being held for way too long, just tapping my foot. No shot here outstays its welcome. And if a shot does have room to breathe, it's for a reason, like the great shot of Chaplin's character foregrounded, alone and lonely with the chaos of the dance hall playing out behind him. Everything in this movie is so perfectly paced. All the bits are really funny. I mean, does it drag a little, but not much. And all the bits work. And Georgia Hale shocked me twice over. First, because she's not underage, which I was expecting for Charlie Chaplin. And second, because she holds her own. She's so good. She pops off the screen with such liveliness and vitality. And her career apparently went nowhere. But both she and Chaplin don't go big. They don't wildly overact. They do small and subtle things that are just big enough for the camera to register, and that makes their performances both stand out, and they complement each other well, I think.
I think it's worth pointing out that Chaplin wrote and directed this movie, so he is the most auteur-like leading character in any of these movies that we've talked about so far. And, you know, really the vision was his, and he was able to enact it, you know, himself. You know, Fred Astaire is a good comparison because, I mean, the Fred Astaire had directors in his movies, but Fred Astaire movies were Fred Astaire movies. And Chaplin, you know, really was the one who had the vision for his films. I haven't seen full-length Chaplin before. I've seen a lot of clips. I know about The Little Tramp. I know about his later films. I've seen City Lights and The Great Dictator and stuff. But it was interesting to sit down and see this movie in its entirety. And, you know, it's a complete film. There's all these movies. I think a lot of us, when we started this silent sampler project, were thinking, oh, all of these are going to be short. And it turns out
they're not short.
Actually full-length movies. So you're welcome.
But this one was a good 80 minutes. Like, it moved at a nice clip. There wasn't a lot of fat on it.
One thing I was thinking when I was watching it was, with a lot of these silent movies, we're looking at them from 100 years hence and thinking, oh, you know, filmmaking has come a long way since these corny, you know, in some ways, movies were made. I didn't think that at all with this. I mean, there were moments of great drama, but what really impressed me was just how elegant Charlie Chaplin was and how he moved so beautifully, even though he's doing the little tramp thing. You know, it takes a lot of grace and a lot of balance to be able to move the way that he does.
And he was a real perfectionist. I watched a documentary. It's called The Real Charlie Chaplin, and it came out a couple years ago on Showtime, and I really recommend it. But it showed what a perfectionist he was when he filmed that Flower Girl scene where he meets the Flower Girl in City Lights. They had 342 takes. It took weeks and weeks and weeks and drove everybody nuts on the set until finally he got it exactly how he wanted it. And I think that was part of his, it seemed to work for him. I mean, you could see a lot of perfectionists, you know, they would just drive everybody crazy and not come up with something brilliant. But he somehow had that kind of alchemy that his perfectionists made things perfect.
By the way, total aside, Chaplin and Louise Brooks were apparently friends. They might have had a thing in, you know, in her early career, but they later became friends, and he would sort of give her advice, most of which she did really take, but I've read biographies of her where it's discussed the relationship that they have, and it's really interesting because, yeah, my only knowledge of Chaplin as a human being outside of his films were all of the terrible things he did in relationships. So it's, I don't know, I guess it's nice that he had a friend.
This, like Shelley, this is the first time I've seen him in a full, like, anything, just little clips and stuff. I was delighted to see the bread roll dance thing because it's something, clip I've seen often. But the scene that I really love the most is, like, just them in the cabin when it's falling off the cliff.
Oh, God.
And how much like, it was both funny but also really tense because they kept falling through and, like, it's showing you the precariousness of the cabin. And it's like, there was a lot of tension in creating that scene. And I was just like, oh, I'm pretty sure they're not going to die here. But at the same time, I thoroughly bought into that. And I also thought this had the nice little romantic plot in it. And I was rooting for him and Georgia at the end.
Do you guys feel like the comedies of the silent era hold up the most because the comedic language hasn't changed that much?
Well, the comedies we're seeing hold up.
Yeah, I think if you, you know, if you watch some Laurel and Hardy, I'm not sure that those necessarily hold up. And I don't know about the Fatty Arbuckle comedies, whether those hold up. But I think the artistic comedy, the artistic comedies do.
I mean, I've seen, so the Oceana Roll dance, I read someone saying that Chaplin took it from Fatty Arbuckle, from a movie called The Rough House. So I looked it up and I found it's there on YouTube, and it was directed by Buster Keaton, because he and Fatty worked together for a long time. And it is, number one, Fatty Arbuckle sticks some forks into rolls and sort of walks along a table with them. But it is nothing like what Chaplin did. But it's also, I think, a relatively early movie of theirs. And it's just slapstick and not especially funny slapstick and not especially daring when you think about what Buster Keaton did later in his career. And it's not even good compared to other things that I've seen Fatty Arbuckle in, who was also a very graceful physical performer. He isn't in that movie. And, you know, lots of movies that I see with great stars of the time don't do anything for me. But Chaplin's movies generally do. And this, to me, and I think Chaplin himself thought that this was, you know, the peak of his career. And certainly it's my favorite of his stuff.
Okay, well, from Charlie Chaplin to Buster Keaton, Nathan, sorry to make you wait till the end, but I would love to hear you talk about The General.
Everyone knows we saved the most tedious for last. No, so there are two things you need to know about The General if you've never seen him before. One, it is that it is maybe the first great action movie, a breathtaking work of inventive, funny, dazzling action. And the second is that it is wildly problematic. Okay, so real life incident. During the Civil War, some very clever and brave troops from the Union snuck into the past the Southern lines into the South, commandeered a train and rode it back to the North, sabotaging everything on their path to cut the Southern supply lines and deal a blow to the Confederacy. What this movie presupposes is, what if they were the bad guys? Yeah. This movie is about a heroic Confederate train engineer and his lovable, old-fashioned, old-timey community who are definitely not enslaving anyone that we see or hear about, and how they have to deal with those dastardly Yankees who are invading them for unspecified reasons. Keaton is the engineer of a train. His train gets kidnapped. His girlfriend gets kidnapped. It is difficult to say which of the two Buster Keaton loves more, but he jumps aboard another train, gives chase, and we get basically the silent movie version of Mad Max Fury Road, in that it is a chase that is basically in one direction and then back the other way, and it's freaking awesome. This is one of those movies where you can absolutely skip everything that happens when they're not on a train. I do that with my kids. My kids love trains. I showed them this movie. I skipped all of the deeply problematic parts that don't involve trains. And it was a great time. Trust me, you can skip everything that doesn't take place on a train. But the joy of this film is watching how they treat this moving train like a playground. And they climb over it, onto it, above it. They slowly hack away at the different boxcars as they're destroyed by fire or by the character's own ingenuity as they turn them into makeshift traps and defenses. There are cannons firing. There are sidetracks and side switches. There's clever sabotage and other trickery. It's just so much fun to watch. There is Buster Keaton riding on the cowcatcher of a moving train using one giant plank of wood to knock the next giant plank of wood that the dastardly Union troops have placed on the tracks to knock any trains that pursue them off out of the way with split-second timing. It's just an incredible, fun, thrilling action movie with a climax where a real live locomotive crashes off a real live bridge in real life Klan-backed white ethno state Oregon in 1926, which maybe that's why they filmed it there. But it is, if you can get past the deeply, deeply problematic aspect of literally almost every part of this film, it's really incredible.
Well, it's not Birth of a Nation, so it's got that going for it.
A love story between a man and his train. I mean, what more do you want?
Well, and it is fun to watch and try to figure out how they did everything. I mean, that's 1926, is that right, when this came out? I mean, the special effects, when you think about what they're doing 100 years ago, are really incredible. And people were putting themselves in physical danger as well, as they were, because he's doing all this stuff.
It's the same reckless disregard for human life and limb that you see in Jackie Chan movies.
I mean, there's no question, and I'm sure that everybody at the time thought this, is that as Keaton is moving from the engine to the tender to the boxcar and back, and he's jumping over these things, he's really doing it. There's no question about it, because that's the kind of performer he was. And I think people in 1926 knew that, and that was certainly a big part of the attraction of his stuff. I mean, apart from the fact that he's funny, is that he's doing these things that, you know, there is a certain amount of camera trickery in Keaton's work, but he's doing most of it. Most of it is just, you know, he's the special effect.
And I compared this to Mad Max Fury Road, and it's a more direct line than you'd think, because in addition to being structured as, like I said, a chase where you go in one direction and then back the other way, George Miller not only put out a black and white cut of Fury Road, but I believe by choice, he designed a lot of Fury Road to be completely comprehensible with the sound off. You can watch that movie with no dialogue whatsoever and still tell with crystal clarity the basics of what is going on. So I feel like it's possible that Fury Road was in some way a homage to this film.
I actually did skip through most of it because I, one, don't really like war movies. And then I was like, Confederates, I've already sat through Birth of a Nation. I'm not going to sit through this. For homework, I was forced to watch it. So I skipped through, and I did stop when we got to the train acrobatics, because I was like, oh, this is actually quite funny and entertaining. And then after I, skipped through a bit, but I was like, this is less of a war movie than I thought it was going to be at first, because I am notoriously good for skipping out on war movies. But it was really funny. And I remember that part you talked about, Nathan, with the planks and using the one plank to the other plank was like remarkable, and I also thought the same thing, like, this seems so dangerous, but it is, the effect of it was kind of magical.
My grandfather was a railroad track man. I have to point, those are called ties. those are not planks, they're ties.
You're right, ties. I should know that.
Sorry, Randy, go ahead.
Oh, that's good. I wanted to talk about the music in silent movies. The last several years, I've gone to silent movies every year here in San Diego. Balboa Park is our big city park, and they have an organ pavilion with a beautiful old organ outside. And every summer, they play silent movies, and they've done comedies the last few years, Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin and Harold Lloyd. And each time, the organist will come out and talk about the soundtrack that they're going to be playing. And I did some research into this, and it turns out that there was not a set piece of music for organists or orchestras to play during silent movies. The movie makers would often give them kind of a suggestion, you know, try play this kind of music here, play that kind of music there, this is a chase scene. But it was really improvised a lot by your local organist, or if you're really fancy theater, you might have an orchestra. So that's why when we watch these movies today, the soundtracks tend to be, have been created within the last few decades as maybe part of a re-release or that kind of thing. That there wasn't an original soundtrack that everyone heard. So it makes you can watch the same movie, and sometimes you'll see that on DVDs or Blu-rays. They'll have different soundtracks from different orchestras or organists that you can compare and contrast.
Yeah, the soundtrack that they used for The Sheik, I found to be pretty distracting, at least the one that was on YouTube. And it was sort of pseudo Middle Eastern music, but at some points it sounded kind of Irish. And I thought, okay, that can't have been what was played in the movie theater along with this movie.
I was impressed by the Nosferatu that I listened to, and I don't know the source of it. But I just remember thinking it was very evocative, and it didn't go too hard. I think what sometimes will happen, and it happened in Diary of a Lost Girl, where when there's a point at which the girl who dies at the beginning, who's drowned herself, we don't know she's dead yet. We don't know what this person wrapped up in the bag is. Who this is or anything, but they start playing the dirge music, and you're like, and it just feels like you're trying to anticipate a little bit too much. But Nosferatu, especially considering the subject matter, I felt like the music was very sort of measured. And then when the scary parts were scary, it did ramp up, and it felt like it was appropriately done. But again, I have no idea the source. There's a local composer here in Austin who, and I'm sure there are other places where this happens, where he will compose a score for a silent movie showing. So they will, bring some well-regarded silent movie along, and he will write something for it. It doesn't happen every week, but every once in a while, there's like a big event where you'll have a composer who will create a score. And I presume that in some cases they have some source material to draw on or some ideas, but in other cases it might be from whole cloth. And I don't know much about that, but I know it happens.
One of the great things about watching a silent movie is that you can turn the sound down. I don't turn it off. I don't mute it or anything, but I do turn it down. And I don't have to worry about missing dialogue. I can turn the sound down so that if the soundtrack is overbearing, and sometimes they get overbearing, you don't hear it. It's not it doesn't blast you out of your seat, which is nice.
One thing that we might not realize today, unless you have a theater nearby that plays silent movies on occasion, is that a lot of theaters at that time had Wurlitzer organs. So you may have an organist playing music to the movie, but these organs would have built-in drums and a piano and sleigh bells and even like a car horn. They could press some keys and make a sound of all these other different kinds of instruments and different kinds of noisemakers. So if you can watch a live performance with a silent movie on a Wurlitzer organ, it's really fun because you'll hear, when they tap the car horn, when there's a car horn in a scene, and those various kinds of sounds. So it makes it a little more fun.
Our local orchestra has, we actually have a magnificent pipe organ, but they are showing at Halloween Nosferatu with live orchestra and organ music, which I think they do every year. And it's one of those things I mean to go to. And now perhaps I am inspired to actually get my butt in the seat and watch the live music with the movie, because that would be very cool.
I saw Metropolis with a performance. I don't remember the details, but it was funny because they showed it. It was at a place that is a sort of a coffee shop during the day and a bar at night, so it doesn't sound very auspicious, but it was done outside, and it wasn't an orchestra. I think it was probably a quartet, but Metropolis being, quite a interesting and arresting movie all on its own, and so the music was very sort of, mechanical and mechanized. It was really appropriate and really interesting, but no organs, just, stringed instruments and horns and I can't remember what all we had.
I Googled Wurlitzer organs, and it looks like the Paramount movie, Paramount Theater in Seattle, they have a mighty Wurlitzer organ, and they play silent movies, it looks like about every 3 months on Mondays. So they have one coming up in January. They're playing Safety Last with Harold Lloyd. They have Sherlock Jr. coming up. So if you're in Seattle, that would be a fun place to get kind of the original experience.
Yeah, I've actually
been to
the Music Box Theater in Chicago is the home of the Chicago Silent Movie. Chicago Silent Movie Society, and I've actually been to a couple of movies there. And most recently, I saw one about horse racing, and Seabiscuit, the actual Seabiscuit horse, appeared in the movie, and quite a good house. There were quite a few people that showed up for that.
And I wanted to mention that there is an annual San Francisco Silent Film Festival at the best place for a movie in San Francisco, the Castro Theater, and they hold that every July. And they
where the organ rises. It's quite a sight to see the organ coming up into the, and he's playing while it's rising up. You know, it's just like it's great.
Yeah.
I'm just so glad that you all were willing to take part in our silent sampler. I mean, we didn't even scratch the surface of the breadth of silent movies. And I was thinking if we wanted to have a silent movie sampler sequel at some point in the future, we could cover some of the filmmakers and actresses that didn't get into our inaugural silent movie sampler.
That is entirely possible. If we can get up a panel, which it sounds like we can, we should do that. And listeners out there, if you have a positive reaction, if you want to hear us do more silent movies or anything like that, let us know.
Any last thoughts on silent movies, these movies, kind of the silent to talkie era in general?
I have just one more thing to say about the general, and it is a scene that is barely a scene. But it's as beautiful as Charlie Chaplin's Roll Dance. And it's when Buster is upset. He's not been allowed to sign up for the war. And he goes back to the general and he sits on the coupling rod between the two wheels. And somebody else gets in the train and starts moving it around. And he is sitting there on, you know, essentially treating the coupling rod as if it's a bench. And as the train moves along, he's going up and down and up and down with it. And it's just gorgeous. I mean, nothing's going on. It's just him and his stone face, and he's moving up and down. And what I thought about this, and I've seen that scene, you know, several times, even outside of watching the movie, because it's so arresting, is that he noticed this. I mean, that's characteristic of coupling rods. They are what's called the parallelogram linkage. that piece always stays horizontal as it moves. And the genius of Keaton was to see that and recognize what he could do with it. And he didn't do anything flashy. He's not jumping around on it or anything like that. He's just sitting. But it's really just a beautiful scene. It's you have to see it. If you have not seen the movie, if you're listening and you haven't seen the movie, you really just have to see it, because it's unbelievable how beautiful it is when it's so simple.
I'll just say that, remind everybody that all of the movies that we talked about tonight are available free on YouTube or from other sources. And so we will have plenty of links for you. So if you haven't seen any of these movies and you want to, we'll have links. Also, I don't usually do this because we talk about one movie per episode, but I'll be putting chapter markers in so that if you want to see skip to a particular movie that you're interested in, that'll be easy if you have a podcast app that does that little thing. Look for the chapter.
Okay.
I think we could also mention that all these movies have their performers at the height of their work on screen. And I think maybe almost all of the stars, or maybe all of them, this was their era. Over the next few years, you know, 5 or 10 years was when they were at the height of their powers, and some of them passed away or moved out of movies. I know Charlie Chaplin had some work in the 50s, but you're really watching these people at the height of their powers. And if you like watching them in these movies, you're going to enjoy them and other things, but you really are seeing them at doing some of their best work.
And the other thing I wanted to mention, you know, I mentioned Gloria Swanson's autobiography, Swanson on Swanson, but she talks in great detail about the expense that these movies went to. She, in her movies, you know, had all her costumes designed for her. She had a French costume designer. She had real jewelry that she was wearing. They were sparing no expense at the time for these movies, and these were literally the casts of thousands, all those extras, you know, all the bit players that we didn't even mention. And so this is Hollywood, the Dream Factory. I mean, this is Hollywood in the 20s, major studios, thousands of people employed in the movies. And, you know, this is where the Hollywood in its classic film days starts to crank up from here. So if you want to understand the roots of where classic movies go, this is silent movies are absolutely the way to start.
Yeah, speaking of the extras, from what I read, when the train blows up on the bridge in the general, they had a dummy playing the engineer, and the crowd that gathered from the town to watch, some of them were horrified because they thought there was a real person in there.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. See, well, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. Thank you, everyone, for taking part in this panel. It's a really fun way to inaugurate silent movies on LTS. So visit the website, which is theincomparable.com/LTS. Find Lion Towers Shield on Twitter, if you're still going to Twitter. Lion Towers Shield's at zeppelin.flights on Mastodon, because S's cost extra. And then you can email us at lts@theincomparable.com. We'll be back next week with the 1932 Ernst Lubitsch comedy, Trouble in Paradise. That's episode 86. I'm Mickey Maynard. Thanks for listening.